Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening, everyone. Happy Shabbat. I'm here with both Kirk and JB this evening, so we have a full cast of characters. How are you fellas this evening?
Good evening.
Doing great.
Good. Well, I appreciate you guys standing in for me last week, and I am now particularly pleased to be able to pick up a complete pickup. And I'm sure you recognize that 2 weeks ago, we were talking about something that was really pretty extraordinary in terms of its implications vis-a-vis the Torah. You know, the two, well, let's just go the three most famous religions. Christianity, which is the biggest religion in the history of the world. Islam, which is the second biggest religion from the popular in the history of the world, and the religion that's considered the mother of all religions, Judaism, all claim that they either have a New Testament, a new recital, Quran means recital, or an oral Torah, right? So they all claim they have a variation of the Torah, correct? Their own replacement of it, their own variation of it. That's the big three religions.
Yes.
So this statement from Shemot names Exodus 12:49 destroys the world's three best-known religions. It says one Torah, not two. You can't have a Torah and an oral law Talmud, can you?
No.
One Torah. You can't have an Old Testament and a New Testament, can you? That one Torah means that the Quran cannot confirm the Torah and then bring an entirely different perspective.
Right.
One Torah. One source of teaching, guidance, instruction, and direction. As we have learned, Torah is not a derivative of any Hebrew word for law. There's nothing associated even remotely with law in the etymology of Torah. Torah is from the verb yara. Not my opinion. I did not come to the opinion or independently come even to the conclusion that Torah was based upon yara. Yara, very precisely, produces the concept of his Torah, telling us that it is based upon the verb yara. So Torah is based upon yara, and yara means the source from which teaching, guidance, direction, and instruction flow. So that's what Torah means.
Mm-hmm.
So one Torah, one source of teaching, one source of guidance. You can't have a Quran, you can't have a Talmud, you can't have a New Testament. One source of teaching. Ichad means one. Ichad is not one of many. He shot his thing soul, solitary, explicit. One Torah. Has, does, and shall actually exist. Actually and always exist. Haya. Was, is, and always shall be. On behalf of the native-born person, Ha-Ezra, the one who was naturally born from Zarak, one who is alert, I just loved it, one who is alert, comes out, rises up, and shines, and the individual from a different ethnicity, birth, who, as a guest, considers the implications while gathering together and dwelling within your midst. Now, what's interesting here is two things. One is that, okay, beyond the just the thing we've already highlighted, one Torah. Mm-hmm. One source of teaching from God. You can't have a Quran. You can't have a Talmud. You can't have a Mishnah. You can't have a New Testament. All those things are completely eliminated from the possibility of being from God. One source of teaching.
One fell swoop.
But I like it. Go ahead.
I said they're all eliminated in one fell swoop.
Correct. Now, what
that,
I like
that verse right there.
Right. There's a distinction here, and the distinction is explained as it relates to the second type of people. So, the Torah exists for two people: the native-born, that is, someone who is naturally born because they were alert as part of Yisrael. But the other group of people that this Torah applies to is not just someone from a different ethnicity, because that would be 99.99% of the people of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It only is a benefit to those of a different ethnicity who decide as a guest to gather together and dwell within the midst of Israel. Now, that doesn't mean physically. We're not talking about geography.
Yeah.
We're not talking about ethnicity. We're talking about people of different races who choose of their own accord to congregate with, to dwell with, to sojourn with, to show reverence and respect and consider the implications of living within the meaning of Yisrael, understanding what the land and the chosen people represent. We are not as goy, as gur in this particular case, but goy and goyim. The Torah doesn't apply to us just as goy, or goyim, the plural, unless we have chosen to be part of Israel, of what it means to be Israel, be part of the family. The covenant was created for Israel. If we choose to be part of that family and dwell together as part of that family, then it applies to us. So the Torah really only applies to those people who choose to be part of the covenant,
right,
and to associate with what it means to be Israel. It's the way it should be, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know what?
And
I don't see it really.
The fact that on Bukkudim, I speak of Bukkudim as being adopted into the family.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I think he's talking about here. Yisrael is naturally born. Those of us who are goy that use the Torah to find how we are being invited into and how we can accept the terms and conditions of the covenant, we're adopted. We are invited, yes. You know, I've put a close on a boat here down in South Florida early next week, and I'm naming her Cara, which, you know, means to be an invited guest, to be welcome,
mm-hmm,
to be invited, and to be welcome. That's what is being said here. We're being invited into an existing family.
I was going to ask you a question. What I don't see in here is the Christian concept of an outreach program to the world. When you read, you know, when did that concept come along? Is that a Pauline concept? Because you really have to find your way to the Torah to become part of Israel. That doesn't mean that we all didn't come there because somebody didn't say something, you know, or
there's a line to it, as you know, it'll go out into all of the world. But understand that what he's asking us to do is to tell the world, reveal his testimony to the world, Yahweh's testimony to the world. That's what we're doing.
Yes.
So, we just celebrated Teruah, and the purpose of Teruah is to proclaim the message to the world, to all those who are willing to listen. But you're not drawing them to a church, something that is separate from Israel. You're not drawing them to a nationality or to patriotism. You're drawing them into Israel. And the whole concept of Islam and of Christianity is to draw people into their own construct. And what instead this is saying is that you're invited as a guest within Israel. But yeah, it's an extremely important concept to know what's at stake here. We're being grafted into an existing tree. We're being adopted into an existing family. There aren't two families.
No.
There aren't two trees. There aren't two countries. There are not two ethnicities. We are being invited and welcomed to join the covenant family. But this does not give any room for the Vatican or Washington, D.C., or for Mecca.
Or the Rambam and his group of rabbis.
But remember how many people we had that they kind of went off the deep end in their conspiracy stuff and became anti-Semitic?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But there ain't no room for anti-Semitism here, is there?
Nope.
You can't be opposed to Yisrael here. Not and be part of God's family. Torah does not apply to you if you are. The next things that I want to share is since God has now told us two things. One is he's told us that he shared his Torah with Abraham. And number two, that there's only one Torah for everyone. Let's consider what else he has to say about Torah, because we ended our program 2 weeks ago with Marshall Word Pictures, Proverbs 4:2. So let's reprise 4:1 and then move on.
Okay.
You all should choose to actually listen. Shema. Of your own free will, all should genuinely elect to literally pay attention and hear this. You know, what's amazing here, this is the Shema in the call imperative. The imperative is an expression of second-person volition. And yet you'll have English translations that say, you must obey.
Uh-huh.
The imperative is an expression of second-person volition. Obey and free will are opposite concepts. Just the moods to which the verb was scribed destroys the concept of obey.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, of course, Shema only means obey. Well, there's two words in Hebrew. Listen and hear are the two words in English that can be used to translate Shema. But that's the opposite. And then you have to express the influence of the call stem, which is a setting up a literal, genuine relationship between subject and object, and the imperative, which is being expressed under the auspices of free will. So you should choose to actually listen of your own free will.
That's the thing. People don't understand. Even in English, you know, there are two ways to interpret the word imperative. When I say it is imperative that you do something,
Yeah, there are two ways you can interpret it. One is it's something you must do or you will be punished. Now, that's the command and control military mindset. It is imperative that you follow your orders or you will be punished. But the other idea behind imperative is it is something you must do. Because it is, yeah, that's the thing with imperative. It is something that has to be done, but it has to be done if you want to bring about a particular result. Yeah, it is imperative that you listen to me and do this if you want these things to happen. And that's the way Yahweh uses it almost exclusively. Is, you know, it is something that you must do. You know, you can't just ignore it, but you don't, you know, right. It's not you have to do out of fear of punishment. It's you have to do if you want to benefit from these results that I'm going to tell you about.
Yeah, I've never really thought of it that way. That's an interesting perspective, JB, is that while it's called the imperative, and imperative has connotations to it that would be the antithesis of free will, you can actually blend the two things together to get a more complete understanding. But keep in mind that 100% of the mood in Hebrew express volition. There is no mood.
Yeah.
Hebrew has some conjugations and mood. So there's only three aspects of grammar. And there's no past and present tense. There are no tenses relative to time. There are conjugations which say ongoing action that has unfolding consequences throughout time, and a completed action, whether it's past or the future, that is complete and total in its activity. Those are the conjugations, only two of them. And there's about 15 different stems, but the stems all establish a relationship between the speaker and those being spoken to. This one with the call stem, which conveys this is a genuine relationship that should be interpreted literally, and an actual connotation ought to be derived from what is being said. Don't interpret this figuratively. Interpret it literally. So that's what the call stem says. The imperative mood, though, is primarily and fundamentally an expression of free will. But there are a number of ways to express choice, free will, in Hebrew. Probably the only language that I'm aware of that has moods that express free will in first, second, and third person. And sometimes free will is expressed in both first and third person. So Yahweh can be speaking to us, and he can use the cohortative and the imperative to say, it is my desire that you choose. That's first and second person volition, right? In this case,
yeah.
The speaker, we are the subject of this sentence. And so what the imperative primarily says is, you should want to do this, you should choose to do this, you should desire to do this, but it's your choice. I'm giving this to you.
Like I said, that
under the office of free will. Now,
actually, when I translate it, I like to use the must because to me that speaks to your mindset. You must want to do this. It's not just that you do it. You know, it's that you want to do it, and that speaks to the mindset of the person. You know, we do these things. Yeah, you know, we celebrate Teruah this week not because we have to, but because we want to. And, you know, for Yahweh, you know, that's what he wants. He wants us to want to. And if we don't want to, yeah, like that's why I mean it when I say it's an imperative in terms of if you want to bring this about, you have to want this. And it links in that way. That's what I love about the imperative mood.
You worked in the school district today, and you worked and improved their technology. And then you came home to your wife and to your daughter. You didn't mm-hmm. come home to your wife and your daughter because you had to, but because you wanted to.
No. Yeah, I look forward
to it. That was very important. It's important here that you want to do this. Did you not only make the choice to do it, but did you enjoy it? Is it something you desire to do?
Speaks against the whole religious coercion aspect where, you know, religious people will go through all these rites and motions, not because they want to. You ask your average Catholic who goes to church and does the whole sit, kneel, still, and sit, kneel, stand, kneel, sit, stand, pray. They don't want to do that. They do it because they're afraid of going to hell. And
correct.
God doesn't want that. You know, he doesn't want you doing it because you're afraid of going to hell. He wants you to want to do it.
Right. Got to be your choice. You got to want. If you don't have the desire, it's never going to happen. Too much learn. Way too much learn. And it's not just that it's too much to learn. It's just there's nothing other than learning and understanding. That is the source of satisfaction, not only for now, but for all time. This continuous voyage of discovery and enlightenment and empowerment that comes from exploring a universe that we can only imagine at this point. But what you were saying is that, from your perspective, that the imperative mood, beyond being an expression of free will, says that, by the way, this is central, that it's not just that you need to choose, that choosing this is important. I'm recommending that you of your own free will choose this. But you're actually extrapolating one step further. If this does not appeal to you, if this is something you don't want to do, then, sorry, there's the...
Go away. Yeah.
In due course.
Yeah, it is a requirement. I mean, it's a requirement not out of fear of punishment, but it's a requirement because, like you said, that's what the universe is going to be. And if that isn't what you want, go away, because we don't want miserable people there. Yahweh don't want miserable people there. He wants people there that are going to want to do all this stuff that he loves and he wants you to love.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I constantly say that the reality is that we're returning to the conditions that were experienced in Eden, which is where there was a constant spirit of dialogue and of enlightenment, this grand adventure and journey through space and time and life. And that if that's what you want, then you're going to find eternity and being part of Yah's family to be rewarding. If that's not what you want, then you're going to hate it there. And the last thing we want is be surrounded by people who are not desirous of listening, of exploring, of observing, of learning, of understanding, of growing, of exploring. So this invitation is, yeah, you should choose to listen. But by the way, if you choose not to listen, there's nothing I can do for you. It is a requirement, listening. And then it says children. And the fact that it says children is also important because all of these mashal, word pictures, problems, 100% of them are written father and mother to sons and daughters. 100% of the perspective, all of it is written as mother, father, to son and daughter. So, by reading them, and I think the preponderance of them were written by Dose, by conveying this instruction from parents to child, God is communicating to us in the only way that he actually wants to relate to us. He does not want to relate to us as worshipers, hate that concept, does not want to relate to us as people who are afraid of him or people who are serving him. He only wants to relate as, you know, I'd like to be dad, and I'd like you to engage with you as if you're my child, because parents can lift their children up, they can nurture them, they can love them, they can enlighten them. So that's the relationship he's trying to establish. So you should choose to actually listen, children. Then. And then, what's the word here? Because we're going to go to Torah in a moment. There are a lot of Hebrew words that convey teaching and instruction. Mutar is one of them. It means truthful teaching and correct instruction. A principal axiom regarding life. A warning, a correction, education, exhortation is from your car to provide instruction which corrects. Now, what was the one thing that Yahweh said about Dove David that beyond the fact he said, you know, I'm his father, he is my son, and the only person that he actually said that about in all of human history, this person is my son, I am his father. What did he say to Dode and about Dode that was particularly enlightening to us in terms of our understanding?
And that he loved him? He was beloved?
That he was right.
Dad, this. He said
he was upright. He was right. Sadek, yes.
He was right. He didn't say he was good. He said he was right. So what does Mukar make? Truthful teaching and
right.
Correct instruction. So if you want to be right, you have to have correct instruction. Instruction which corrects our thinking. But the single most important thing God can do for us is give us guidance and instruction to correct our thinking so that our thinking is correct and it is right, because that's the only thing that matters in the end. So this is truthful teaching and correct instruction. Of whom?
Of Yahweh.
Of the Father. Yeah, of the Father. Father, mother-daughter relationships pick up. And of your own volition, pay attention. Kishab. Kishab is it's sort of like shamar, in the sense that shamar means to closely examine and carefully consider. But kishab doesn't carry the observe aspect of it, because he just asked us to listen.
Mm-hmm.
So it means to pay attention to what you just heard. You know, I've extrapolated based upon the lexicon on Shema and say, you know, it means to listen and to hear and to pay attention. But in this particular case, God's not being redundant. He's not being verbose. He's using Kishab to say, listen, pay attention. Not just listen. Don't let it go in one or out the other. Pay attention to what you're hearing. Process what you're hearing. Consider it. Accept the information. Respond to it. And in this particular case, it was the hypocrite imperative. So again, imperative, an expression of second person volition. Yeah, our choice. But then it was written in the Hippel stem. And the Hippel stem, the subject, who is the Father, empowers and enables the object, you and me, his children, such that we can engage in the process as if we were like him, so long as we choose this course of action. The Hippel stem, with the Hippel stem, the subject, who in this case is the Father of Yahweh, enables the subject who pays attention, who chooses to pay attention, to engage in such a way that we become like the subject. We become like God. It is the perfect stem here, because it tells us the effect of the correct instruction. So you should choose to actually listen, children, to the truthful teaching and correct instruction of the Father. And of your own volition, pay attention. Accept this information and respond appropriately. So to become familiar with and know. Yada. Now, it's obvious that I have an affinity for the word yada. I mean, the first volume of books was called Yada Yada. Yada is one of the most important of all Hebrew terms. At the time that I started writing, guys, I think you know that Yada was my single favorite term. You know, you hear it on signs like Yada, Yada. Well, Yada means to know.
To know.
To become familiar. The thing that about Yada that is interesting is diak is the Hebrew word to know in an empirical sense. Yada is to know in a relational sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's to become familiar with someone, to acknowledge someone, to become aware of someone, to care about someone, to respect someone, to embrace someone. So it is relational knowledge is the purpose of yada.
Well, the way I describe it to people is, to me, yada is like intimate knowledge. You know, it's literally the word used whenever you read throughout all of like Genesis, and you know, Adam knew Chawa, and she brought forth. You know, it's literally the word used most often to describe intercourse. That's how intimate of knowledge it is. You know, it's a very intimate knowledge of something. It's not just a cursory knowledge. It's, you know, it's personal and in-depth and intimate.
It's a relational concept. Intimacy is a very close brain, personal kind of knowing and knowledge. That's why intimacy is so important in a loving relationship. Yada is intimate knowledge. It is knowing, acknowledging, being aware of, caring about, respecting, and embracing someone that you're coming to know. Yada. That's why I called this whole initial series of five volumes yada yada. Because we're coming to know in an intimate and relational way. But there is a Hebrew verb that I think now is actually more important than yada. But it's not a verb that I could have ever entitled a book, because it takes way too long. It takes much too great a desire to learn, ever have an appreciation of the most powerful concept in the universe. There is something more powerful and more important than knowing. Now, I've talked to people recently about the difference between believing and knowing, and, you know, they'll say, you know, what do you believe? And I'll say, I don't believe anything. Why would I bother with belief? When you know, you don't need to believe. In fact, the moment you know, belief becomes meaningless. It's a useless concept. Belief is what happens when you don't know. You have to have faith. You have to have belief when you don't know. Once you know, there's no reason to have faith. There's no reason to believe. You have confidence because you know.
I told someone the other day, belief is like an opinion. You know, I believe that vanilla ice cream is better than chocolate. That's my opinion. Yeah, I can't prove that statistically, verifiably, factually, but in my opinion, it is. Yeah, that's what a belief is. It's an opinion.
But in this case, yada, which is to know in a relational sense, is one thing. The most empowering concept in the universe is one chance. But understanding is impossible without first listening, without first or second knowing what to consider and how to consider it. So it's about shama, and then it's about mukar. But it's not just shama and mukar, which is truthful teaching and correct instruction. It's shama as children to the mukar, the truthful teaching and correct instruction of the father. That's the perspective, and perspective is the mother's milk of understanding. Until you have the proper perspective, all of the knowledge in the world doesn't do any good. Perspective is essential to translating. It's essential to knowing. It's essential to understanding. So we're being given the perspective, listen to our Father and the teaching of our Father, and pay especially close attention. Why? So as to become familiar with and know. But that's not the end of it. There's a verb that follows it that's more powerful than knowing. The single most powerful thing that we can benefit from in the universe. I suspect it is the single most powerful thing, not only in the universe as we know it in 3.5 dimensions. I suspect Bina is the most powerful, the most enriching, the most enlightening, the most empowering concept, even in seven dimensions.
I can't think of anything that could ever replace it.
Yes, to understand. You know, I've shared this so many times before, and I said, you know, I don't want to do ratio on these books, because there will be people who listen that will know more than I do. And I might say something or not be able to properly explain or defend something if challenged by someone who knows more than I do. And I didn't want to embarrass the source of these words, the God for whom I was translating these words and trying to explain these words. And so it always made me nervous, because I realized I was Moshe. I was the mumbler. And so it made me nervous. I realized I'm not going to be pronouncing all of the Hebrew terms correctly, and that there will be a lot of people that know Hebrew a lot better than I do. So people will be more familiar with the full stories and the text of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms than I am. And so I was concerned that I would be embarrassed and by being embarrassed, I might bring discredit to my father's message. Yes, and his message. And then it wasn't within days of beginning that I realized, why am I worried about this? Because I've been given through devotion to it, through my desire to learn, I've been given something that now, you know, it's one in a million people possess. Something vastly more valuable than the scholar has. Something vastly more valuable than the people that might know, you know, having a PhD means you know a lot of stuff, but you don't understand any of it. Being a scholar, you are an expert in all things pertaining to your field, but you don't have any understanding. We have been given something extraordinary. I can't say we've been given. We have earned. We really have. We've earned this position where we've come to understand. Yeah, we've been facilitated. Yes, we knew. We came to know who to listen to. We came to understand the perspective that was important. Children to a father. We understood where to go to find the truthful teaching and the correct instruction. And we become familiar with the source, and we know what he has to say so that we've come to understand. And because we understand, there is no way in the world we could embarrass the Lord's message. It's impossible.
You know, as I sat here and listened to y'all, and I was looking over my notes, and the thing that also reinforces that, because I've studied hard, and I do know what the truth when I see it, and the straight stick versus the crooked stick, but I look at these notes that I've been making on all of this on Marshall 4:1. There's nothing that y'all brought up that I wasn't able to find and put together, and that's comforting too. So it reinforces that my understanding was correct and my perspective was correct. So that's the encouraging part. And I don't know of any place I've ever been where someone said, I'm going to teach you this, or I'm going to share with you what I know, and here's how you prove it. And that to me was like a game changer. So the reason I do the lookup of word after word after word after word is just to reinforce it, even though sometimes I know that, yes, I know that, and I can almost do it before I look it up. I can write it all down. But I find it fascinating every time I do it that it's like when you said Mukar, it's truthful, education, instructive, and something that can be redirected because of correction. There's almost no adjective that you didn't use that you can't find there. And that's comforting when you tell somebody or when you share it with those people out there that are listening, our friends and family members, that they actually look it up and they say, you know, I don't care where you go. Every lexicon you go to, it'll say exactly the same thing with a few caveats of look out when it says law because that's injected and you know that doesn't make any sense. But it's
Yes.
Anyway, that's...
You know, today I sat down to do some work and, you know, the passage I was translating, once I finished, I looked up and found out, you know, Craig had translated. I thought I'd remembered reading it before in one of Craig's books, so I looked it up and I compared, you know, side by side my translation to his. And, yeah, you know, while nuances were different here and there, we came up with pretty much the same basic message. Yeah, you know, worded slightly different based on our translation styles, but, you know, the facts are the facts, and you can't get beyond that. And, you know, the message is clear as can be.
Right. Well, I think you'll find also when you go back to the most ancient meanings that'll just reinforce what you've already found. I mean, it's over and over and over again. The earliest understanding of what these words means, they have not changed to that degree that you know exactly what he's trying to convey. Yahweh just doesn't change. His language doesn't change.
Well, I think you were the one, Kirk, that pointed this out, and I think it's really helped me is you know, the concrete nature versus the abstract nature of Hebrew language. And when I look at a definition of a word, and there's six different definitions, you start looking at what is the most concrete definition, the most, you know, physically descriptive, the least abstract. That's right. Probably the original meaning. And then, you know, you can see how the other meanings, you know, were developed from that. You know, okay, well, because this means this, they began using it as this, and you can see that. But that really helped me a lot in a lot of those regards where, yeah, just look at the most concrete, basic meaning of the word. Yeah, you can then you can see how everything else, you know, the other five definitions are extrapolated from that, but focus on that concrete definition.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for example, in Shama, to pay attention is a derivative. It's an extrapolation from the primary meaning. Primary meaning is to listen and to hear. And since it's in the call stem, which is literally and actually and genuinely, you can extrapolate, well, you know, not just listen, but pay attention. So it's an extrapolation. Mukhar, the meaning of mukhar is correct instruction. Truthful teaching and correct instruction. But a derivative of that, an extrapolation of that, is an exhortation. And to, focus in on a principled axiom. And you realize it's from Yakar, so it's instruction which corrects. So there are extrapolations of some of these words. But
there's actually a natural evolution of a language. You know, you learn to use these words to describe the situations. But it's like, I love Kirk's point, though, about, you know, it was a very concrete language, whereas English is largely derived from Latin, which is a very abstract language. It's about emotions, feelings, not about concrete, realistic things. And so learning to change your mindset to that, I think, is one of the biggest benefits you can have in really coming to understand and learn Hebrew and the Torah. Is think about things in a very, you can extrapolate out and afterwards, but once you understand that core concrete concept, then you get why, okay, here it's used, but the concrete concept doesn't fit. So what does it mean? Okay, well, you know, I was looking at one today that was, you know, speaking of hardened is the way English translators, you know, translate it, but the word meant to strengthen or to secure. And you can get where hardened came from because something that has been hardened is strengthened and secured. But, you know, it wouldn't be the natural way to go with it initially. And then once you understand that core basic, the statement made sense. The verse I was looking at was where it talks about Yahweh, quote-unquote, hardening Pharaoh's heart. And when you understand what that word really means, you know, the whole idea that this is a statement against free will goes out the window.
A great example of this is Bana, what it means to understand. Because Bana is based upon, it's actually the feminine of BM. And BM means to make a connection between things. So, making a connection is how you go from knowledge to understanding. If you simply know a lot of, without knowing a lot of things, you cannot make the connection to understand. But if you simply know things and you're unable to relate them in an intelligent way, a connection between them, then you're never going to understand. But bien, feminine, viena, is it's a feminine approach to making connections. So you see the relationship between the facts, or in the case of yada, yada means to become familiar with it, a relational knowledge, a relationship knowledge. So now you're coming to understand the nature of the relationship. And there is nothing more empowering in the universe than understanding. There is nothing that you could give anyone. Well, you can't give. Understanding can never be a gift. It is something you earn.
No.
But there is.
You can help someone with, but you can't give it to them.
It's empowering or uplifting or liberating than understanding. Understanding trumps. All of the armies that have ever marched are trumped with understanding. All of the money that's ever been made is meaningless compared to understanding. Vena is the great jewel means to make a connection. It tells us how we transition from knowing to understanding by making these relationships and connections between things that work together. For example, we're talking about listening and then mukar to instruction. Children and father, that's the perspective that we're supposed to, that we're being encouraged to use here. And then, again, this transition from yada to bina, which is you start with knowing, well, first you start with listening, with mukar to correct instruction, proper perspective, child to father, kasab, paying close attention, processing it, considering it. So as to yada, to know, making the connections that ultimately leads to bina, understanding. Now, why do you think that bina was written in the feminine as opposed to just bien?
Because of the Ruach Kodesh.
I think that's to understand. Her spirit is feminine. She is more responsible for us understanding than even the words by themselves of the Father. I think it's
most of the Proverbs are kind of written from the perspective of the Ruach HaKodesh.
Yeah. They are. Yeah, our spiritual mother. I think it goes one step beyond that. I think I've shared in the past that when I went in for LASIK surgery for my eyes, I told the doctor that I wanted him to take my my left eye and to change the focal length of my left eye so it only was capable of seeing that which I was reading. So I didn't need the magnifier to read my computer or book or, you know, a newspaper. And I wanted my right eye focused for long distance. So I have 20/20 long distance in my right eye, 20/20 vision, close up reading with my left eye. That's what I asked him to do. And he said, just laughed at me. And he said, if you were a woman, I would do that in a heartbeat. With women on LASIK, they will have one eye close, one eye far. Because women can multitask, and they can, in their mind, see the connection between many different things, can process many things simultaneously. A man cannot. You cannot, with a man, have that same kind of surgery, because if we try to blend near and far together, we become blind as a bat. We can't see a thing. Everything is muddled. But if you do that for a woman, she can see clearly far and near simultaneously, because that's how their brains work. So I think there's something that I learned about LASIK and women being able to multitask and process multiple things at a time, and men being incapable of doing it. What it tells us is, if we were to look at bien, just masculine, bienna, feminine, recognizing the hey at the end of a Hebrew word makes the word feminine, is this: if we approach knowledge from the perspective of how a woman's brain works, which is to multitask, to look at many aspects of things simultaneously, to see the relationship between many different things, to be able to relate to many different things, we can transition from knowing to understanding. I suspect that's why it's in the feminine. As well as, of course, the enlightenment of the Ruach Kodesh. Vienna. So Vienna, I have a really long definition of Vienna here in the text. I'm just going to share it before we move on. It's how to deduce the intended meaning from a given revelation and then respond appropriately to life situations, to recognize how to distinguish between right and wrong, to become discerning and discriminate by exercising good judgment, how to become perceptive and insightful through instruction, consideration, and contemplation so as to be intelligent, the capacity to separate fact from fiction, from being, to make connections between things, which lead to understanding.
Sure.
I had a conversation with someone about a week ago where it says, you know, without hate, there is no love. Without right, there is no wrong. Without wrong, there is no right. Without good, there is no bad. Without bad, there is no good. that you have to have these contrasts to have things have meaning. You know, good is beneficial, for example, is understood in context of that which is counterproductive. So that is what is meant by Benna. Powerful concept, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Extremely.
Yeah. So then, following that in 4.2, now, as context is everything that you want to understand, and keep in mind here, the context is listen from the perspective of a child to your father for the correct instruction so that you know, making the proper connections so that you understand. That's the context. For indeed, this is important, trustworthy, and reliable. Good, beneficial, and valuable. Both. So that which is productive, proper, favorable, functional, beneficial, pleasing, enjoyable, helpful, useful, appropriate. Hope is a spectacular word. For indeed, good, beneficial, and valuable teaching and instruction. Lakar. When we were just dealing with Mukar, correct instruction. And now we have a second Hebrew word for teaching and instruction. Lakar. Persuasive words which are empowering and invoke change. Information which provides insight, which lead to comprehension. Powerful teaching and instruction. Discourse that can be received in your hand, grasp hold of, and accepted. For indeed, good, beneficial, and valuable teaching and instruction. What is this? God speaking in first person as our Father, to us, his children. I have given for you to approach Nathan La'aka. Nathan is primarily the Hebrew word for that. I have given. But you know, it also is the conveys, I have placed before you. I have offered to you. So I have given. And then La is that is a preposition which speaks of approaching, drawing near, coming close, making a connection between things so that you have the opportunity to be part of the approach. So, indeed, this is important, trustworthy, reliable, moral, proper, favorable, and functional, beautiful, and pleasing, teaching and instruction, empowering words, information which provides insights and leads to comprehension for you to approach. I have actually produced, provided, and bestowed. Well, what did he give us?
Torah.
And what is he saying? What's the next word?
My Torah.
My Torah.
Yeah. Right. And in Hebrew, the next word is actually Torah because Ani follows, is attached to Torah. My Torah.
Torah of mine.
My source of teaching, guidance, direction, and instruction. Now, did he say the Jewish Talmud?
No.
Did he say the New Testament? Did he say that?
He didn't say the Jewish Torah, like Christians would call it.
No.
That Jewish Torah.
Oh, Jewish Torah. Yeah.
Right. His Torah.
How many Christianity will say that? Well, the Torah was for the Jews. Well, it doesn't say the Jewish Torah. Here, but...
Nope. It's
well, of course, the teacher here is God, and he says, "Ani, my." Me, myself, and I. My Torah. My source of teaching, guidance, direction, and instruction. My written and confirming way of treating people. Giving you the means to explore, to seek, to find, and to choose. Yarva, the source from which instruction, teaching, guidance, and direction flow, has been poured out to you, which is told. Beneficial. Facilitating your restoration and return. Even your response and reply to that which is pleasing, joyful, beneficial, and healing. You should never forsake, neglect, or reject. Well, now when Yosha made the statement, and as you guys have covered it, and it's recorded to not well, 5-7, do not think that I came to annul, do away with, forsake, neglect, or reject the Torah.
Pretty sure that would have been Azab.
Yeah, he would have said Azab. And guess what verb is here? Azab. That's the verb he used.
You think he was paraphrasing this?
Yeah. Of course. Yeah, in fact, you know, in Hebrew, the subject object, you know, subject verb object, can be reversed from English, and can be reversed from what is in Greek. So, you know, do not think that I came to neglect or reject the Torah. In Hebrew, can read my Torah. You should not ever forsake, neglect, or reject.
Yeah.
A paraphrase, indeed. I didn't.
Yeah, right. Quoted it.
Yes.
If that's the case,
how can there be Rabbinic Judaism of the Talmud? How can there be a Christian New Testament? How can there be a Pauline letter from God? How can there be a Quran?
There can't.
And not
maybe
even
a rabbi or a preacher is. Let me ask you one little thing, or add one little thing to Laquoc, because this struck me as how rich the words are in this sentence. When y'all just said Laquoc is learning and teaching and insight and persuasiveness,
yeah.
Perhaps. The earliest meaning is I found quite interesting. It also includes gathering. It says to receive what is given, to gain possession of, to take, and you said this too, to take the instruction or to take hold of this. And all of that we gather, especially this week, it was rather close to home because we're going through some Moed Mikros at the present time. So it's not only learning and teaching and insight, but it's insight is almost implying here, at least the way I'm reading it, it's almost implying here a very specific insight on those of the Mitzvah, or at least the Moed Mikra, of our pathway on the meetings we meet with him each year. So...
one of the things that's just hinted at here, Kirk, that is profound, is that in this particular case, the verb happens to be based upon another Hebrew verb. And Laquoc, as a Hebrew verb, primarily means to grasp hold of, to take by the hand.
Right.
So in other words, we are benefiting from this teaching we're benefiting from, we can grasp hold of in our hands. We can take possession of. So it's teaching that can be grasped hold of. The Torah is teaching that we can grasp hold of, right?
Right.
Uh-huh. So especially when you juxtapose that to the oral Torah of the rabbis or the recitals of the Quran.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing,
what we have of the Talmud is all word by word passed down. Supposedly, this oral Torah, the same thing. The Quran was just recitals that were passed down word to mouth. There wasn't something you could take and grasp hold of for most of its existence.
Most
of its existence at this point, but for the larger, the beginning of its existence at least.
When David wrote his Psalm, and when he wrote his Proverbs, how were they written? Is there a Jewish word that would describe the relationship of these words to the music to which they were set?
Oh, the song.
Poetry.
Yes, poetry and lyrics, poetic lyrics.
Song and verse,
lyrical.
But
music
the advantage
lyrics
of poetry
to music
is that poetry there are two types of poetry. Or three types of poetry. Poetry that is rhythm, there's poetry that is rhyme, and there's Hebrew poetry, which is written as couplets, where the same thing is said using different words that help you better understand what is being conveyed, because the same thing is being said, just using different words. The reason I bring that up, we're reading a mashal written by Dode, so these are the lyrics in the Hebrew style of poetry. Now, why is that important here? Well, the first sentence is, "For indeed, good, beneficial, and valuable teaching and instruction I have given for you to approach." That's the first part of the couplet. My Torah, my source of teaching, guidance, direction, and instruction, you should never forsake, neglect, or reject. So, what do we have here? What we have is a couplet that affirms that Torah means teaching and guidance, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
So, same concept in different words. Same exact.
Love that about Hebrew poetry. It just makes, it's great for explaining things in a, you know, again, a poetic way. I love that. Just explain it this way and explain the same thing in a different way.
Right.
Leave it to Yahweh's language to be perfect for that.
So the first one is, the source of teaching is beneficial, it's beautiful, it's pleasing, it's productive, and that's why I have given you this instruction. The second is, now that I have given you beneficial and favorable and valuable and good instruction, don't neglect it. Don't ignore it. Don't ignore it. Don't absorb. Don't forsake it. Don't reject it. And yet the
it's only good if you understand it.
The two most popular religions in the history of the world have both done just that. They've neglected it and rejected it. And what's so stunning is the first public statement that Yosha made is that don't do that.
I gotta step away for a minute. I gotta go help the wife with a sick baby. I'll be back in a little bit.
Okay.
And look at how this is written. It's written in the all imperfect juices. So it's a literal expression of ongoing consequences. Powerful, these statements. Okay. 4:3. Because I will actually come to exist as a son, to approach my kind and responsive father, and thus the only and unique son by way of the mother's presence. Kirk, I think I could talk about this statement for weeks.
Mm-hmm.
What this says is, okay, Yosha is going to come upon the scene, and he is going to announce himself via Proverbs 4. And that's how he began. Sermon on the Mount, his first public declaration.
Mm-hmm.
He came and made this particular announcement. So the son comes onto the scene and says, don't think I've come to annul this. He says, you really, if you want to approach, you approach by listening to this, by caring about it, by understanding the correct teaching. And then it even talks about the realization that the Son is the begotten of the Father by way of the Mother's presence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many times have we talked about the fact that Yosha was born as a normal kid?
That's right.
And that he did not become uniquely the Yahweh's diminished manifestation on earth until the set-apart spirit in the Yardan came upon him with the mother's presence.
Uh-huh. You know, Yachad, or yeah, Yachid, or Yachad, in there is also, when I was looking it up, it became a solitary, to unite together, to put together, to form a single unit, a family unit of father, mother, child, which is what we've always been, or which I've always been saying, and I've joined the choir, of all-encompassing, of representation, representative of Yahweh. Not, you know, he has to separate himself, obviously, to come into the world, But he promised Moshe he was going to send a human being, or choose a human being. And
yeah.
Yehoshua became that, and then he empowered him when it was time for him to go and tell the story and become the Passover lamb. So it's every word.
You know, when you realize what this just flowed out of,
mm-hmm.
it tells you that the Son, Yehoshua, is a living manifestation of this message. That by listening to him, you're listening to God. That by listening to him, you're getting correct teaching.
Right.
That he's the living embodiment of the Torah. Right? The transition between the two reveals that he is the living manifestation of the Torah by way of the Father and the Son. And then he explains what it means to be a child of God. Representing the Father as a Son by way of the set-apart spirit, our mother. So, that is such a perfect explanation. And I want to conclude with this, and we'll pick up beyond that in another program. Because if there is a purpose of Yosha's life beyond fulfilling Pesach, Matzah, Bukudim, and Shavuah, which are essential to us being part of God's family, becoming immortal and perfected and adopted, and then enriched and empowered, is that what he provided is a tangible guidance for us, tangible teaching that is becomes physically manifest. And so this says, and so he will teach and guide them. So Yosha is saying that Yahweh's instruction will teach and guide him. And by saying that, then we're told that he is, what that means is that we will be taught and guided by the relationship of Son to Father.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we are taught and guided by the relationship of God, Son to Father. He is the embodiment of God's teaching guidance, which is just what's so odd about, of course, Christianity. They want to create a religion that's opposed to the Torah when Yosha was, in fact, Torah observant.
Yeah.
So how do you create a religion based on someone who is Torah observant by rejecting the Torah?
You know, you obviously don't look at it.
No.
My through this whole last few weeks, my looking at, I've become so disgusted by people who go to seminary and study these things and pick up these books or supposedly pick up these books. I know they don't always. We had a family friend. She bought a theological workbook, and it was from a seminary student, and he never opened it. He'd gotten through seminary and never even opened it up. And that's why she got it so cheap. It was brand new, she said. I was Mary. And what are they? You know, I wrote down several times in my little corner columns. I said, what do these people read? What lexicon? Do they not show them how to use the lexicon? How do you ever think about Yosha and not want to know what it would have said in Hebrew? And in most of the columns of the old Bibles, it would say, this is connected to this verse in Isaiah, this is verse in such and such, and you go to it, and it's almost verbatim. And we did some of that last week, where we looked at the things that were verbatim in both the Greek as translations as well as those in the Hebrew. And it's like, what is wrong with these people? And I mean, it's a rhetorical question at this point. I mean, we know they have an agenda, and they're trained to do what they're doing, and they're just brain dead, or they're all part of the organization, or whatever. But I don't have any feelings of warm and fuzzy feelings at all about these people anymore. I mean, it's just I don't care how nice they are or how good they are to the mama and the dogs. It's terrible. Because they represent Yahweh.
In this particular case, the speaker now is the Son. And we have so many examples of the Son talking to the Father. Well, here is the Son listening to the Father. And he, the Father, said to me, the Son, accept, trust, uphold and retain. This is Tamak. Please receive. Take, grasp hold of, and embrace. Call him Perfect Joseph. My words. He is the living embodiment of the word of Yahweh. My words, my statements, my message upon your heart and facilitate good judgment, Lev. Focus upon and literally observe what is Shamar. Yosef is Torah observant. He is a living manifestation of the word of Yah, and he is Torah observant regarding my instruction as it relates to the terms and conditions of the relationship agreement, mitzvah, and live forever. Eternal life, Hayah, be restored
to
life.
Ignore, how do you ignore that comment, mitzvah, Shamar,
yeah.
Torah, Shamar,
Mitzvah? Mitzvah with pictures, Prophet 4:4. So, and he said to me, this is the Father speaking to the Son, accept, trust, uphold, and retain my words upon your heart to facilitate good judgment. Focus upon and literally observe my instructions regarding the conditions of the relationship and live forever.
Therefore, Yahushua has to agree with these terms, and this is what he's doing, and he's not doing a new religion. What's slam dunk? Over.
The means to eternal life are by observing the and accepting, upholding the word of Yahweh. When this is being written, was there a Christian testament?
No.
Is God's word, is Yahweh's word conveyed in the Christian testament?
It would be hard to extrapolate it from. But it is if you quote Yosha.
I think it must have been when Yosha is saying it, but even then, he's speaking Hebrew. It's been retained, unfortunately, and translated into Greek and then to English and poorly maintained. So, the word of Yahweh is at this time in the Torah. Full stop.
That's the only place, yes. Yes.
That would be the place. No other place. I don't know how people miss that. So, listen to my words. Accept them. Don't reject them. Accept them.
Yeah.
Don't reject. You know, like Paul said, you have to reject the Torah to be saved. Don't reject my words. Accept them. Embrace them.
But if you reject the mitzvah, then you can't have a continuing life. It's just that simple. Or else Yah's a lie.
Because if you understand the instructions regarding the relationship agreement, you're going to live forever.
Yeah. God, is that enough? Isn't that enough for you? Isn't that a gift enough for anybody? Wow.
That is enough for you.
It's enough for me.
So those are four statements. One proverb, one Rachel, explained by Dode from the perspective of the father, mother, and son. Family. When we pick up next week, we're going to begin with Mashal, Word Pictures, Proverbs 6:23. It talks about the Torah is light, and it's the way of life. So, it's just a marvelous way to reinforce what we've just heard. Want eternal life? Observe the Torah. Want to be transformed into light? Observe the Torah. We're going to find couplets of poetry once again that parallel one another. They're going to help us understand exactly what the Torah is and what it will do for us in terms of transforming us.
Right. How many times does he say Azov?
He adds the good daughter.
Don't reject the Torah.
I think,
over and over. Yeah.
Yeah. The core of everything is the teaching, the reliable and correct instruction of the Father. That is where it begins, that's where it ends. That's the source of knowledge, the source of understanding, the source of enlightenment or light.
and the source of life.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is all of those things. I would become part of the family and live forever.
Yeah. So, happy Yom Kippurim this week to everyone. And you
we will set it up. Reconciliation. Yes. To be reconciled. Of course, the reconciliation is the reconciliation of Yisrael and Yahudah with Yahweh. Yes. And the fact that we can be reconciled into Yisrael and therefore be reconciled into the covenant as well. It's a celebration of the relationship being reconciled, being restored, being renewed. A marvelous celebration of family and of life and of relationship. Yom Kippur. Thank you, Kirk.
Okay. Yeah, well, thank you all. And we want to hear all about the vote next week.
Yeah, yeah. Live and
sorry, I had to step away. We got a baby girl dealing with a small case. We got it early on, but she got a little pink eye, so we're having to give her eye drops, and she wants Daddy to hold her while Mommy does it, so I got to go help out with that.
That's sweet. Well, enjoy. Happy Chag, if they say, celebrate. Yom, the day of reconciliation. Yom Kippur.
All right.
Yep.
And shalom, shalom to both of you.
Shalom.
Shalom.
Thank you, gentlemen.
See you next week.
Enjoy.
Bye.